Chair, this meeting today. This is the Legislative and Rules Committee meeting. It's November 30th. It's now 10:03, and we're holding our meeting by Zoom. So thank you, staff, for setting this up for us. We really appreciate it. Can we have a roll call?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Bohansky?
Present.
Dr. Davey? Mr. Diner?
Present.
And Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Thank you. You have a quorum.
All right. Thank you. Third item on today's agenda is approval of the September 21st, 2020 meeting minutes. Is there
moved.
Was that a motion?
Yes.
Thank you.
Seconded.
And we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Item four, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding this Arizona Psychological Association's legislative plans to establish prescriptive authority for psychologists. Executive Director, did you want to provide an introduction to this topic?
Yes, Madam Chair. Very briefly, Dr. Berry has indicated that there's new information to share with the committee. He has indicated throughout the discussions this fall and into this winter that association would keep the board apprised of developments on this topic. So welcome to Dr. Berry, and I think he's prepared to give us that update.
Right. Thank you. Dr. Berry, welcome to the meeting.
Thank you, ma'am. I will be brief. We have two significant updates to report this morning. The first one is that APA did approve our grant application for $5,000. Completion of the final draft of the application designated that money to be used for developing materials for lobbying on behalf of the prescription authority for psychologists in Arizona. So we're excited about that. We're hoping that that can include at least one video testimonial from a physician in New Mexico who uses or who has psychologists on his staff who prescribe and has been very pleased with the work of those psychologists. So that's a significant step forward. The second item for me to report is that immediately after this meeting today, I will be part of a presentation to the Children's Justice Task Force, which has about 20 members of various state and private agencies, it looks like, with somebody from the governor's office also on the task force. And three of us will have been invited, actually, to present on the proposal to add prescriptive authority to psychologists who meet those educational and experiential criteria.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions? Just to clarify, so when a psychologist gets prescription authority, they're working as an independent, they're not working under a doctor, is that correct?
Ultimately,
a physician,
yes.
Assistant, I understand, works under a doctor's kind of umbrella.
Correct. Yeah, so, the comparison is much better to a nurse practitioner who in Arizona is able to practice independently. And that's following for both nurse practitioners and psychologists. It follows a period of after didactic training and a master's degree in psychopharmacology, psychologists will be required to spend a specified amount of time under the supervision of a physician before he or she is able to prescribe independently.
Under the nurse practitioner, who regulates the nurses prescribing medicine? Is it under the nurses a board like us, or is it under a different board?
My understanding is that it's under the Board of Nursing.
Okay. That's correct. All right. So, well, congratulations on the grant. That's exciting news. Any questions?
We're still looking at not this legislative session, but next.
Yes, that's correct, Bob.
Okay.
And Dr. Berry, are you hearing a lot of, there's a strong interest in this from psychologists? Do you think it would be a small group? Your experience, what are your thoughts?
Honestly, obviously we're talking about psychologists entering the field now and in the future. Historically, over the last 30 years, probably, that this has been a topic of discussion within psychology. It's a very mixed message. One of the criticisms from within of this effort is that not all psychologists are interested in having this responsibility or tool in their tool bag. We have for many years had psychologists who prescribe. It continues to be a very small number of us. And I expect that number will increase, but even in states where it has become legal, I think the numbers of psychologists in those states who have prescriptive authority has remained pretty small.
Well, just what is the test? Like, you know, when you be, and I'm not a psychologist, so I represent the general public. So the test for a psychologist is ECCP. You take the ECCP, you know, you get your, so what would there be a new defined exam for those that want to provide prescriptive medicine to determine their knowledge and abilities?
Yes. In addition to the academic master's degree and the supervised training under a physician, there is a national exam. It has been in place for quite some time. All psychologists in every state that has approved prescriptive authority requires passage of that national exam. My understanding is it's very rigorous.
All right. Thanks. I didn't know that. I appreciate that. I didn't realize that. Sure. Thank you.
Okay, the exam is also owned by ASPPB, who was asked to take over the administration of that examination, so that all psychology exams are under one rubric.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Berry from the boards? Hearing none. So you move forward, and you'll just keep us abreast of the progress?
Happy to do that.
That would be great. Is there any action that we need to take, Heidi?
None at this time.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate it. Thank you for coming in. And, you know, it's kind of exciting. So, let us know how this progresses.
Thank you. I will.
All right. Thank you. Is there just a quick question on this topic, though? Do we need to receive or go out and get comment from the general public in regards to this and that we would be then regulating it and how it would be regulated at some point?
I think if the legislature changes the statutory framework to allow this, there would probably be rules that would be necessary, and those would go through the regular rulemaking process.
Okay.
Which would allow for public comment.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Any other comments on this topic? All right, hearing none. Thank you, Dr. Berry, for being with us. All right, moving on to item number 4, discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning potential proposed legislative changes before the 2021 Arizona Legislature first regular session. The first one has to do with the regulation of independent medical examiners as performed by psychologists. Executive Director, would like to provide an update?
Yes, Madam Chair. So just a brief history of this issue. The board, of course, has struggled with in the past with this realization that the ability to regulate or investigate claims of misconduct on the part of psychologists has been limited due to the statute ARS 23-1026 at subsection D, which prescribes investigative immunity, as we have noted in the past. So the board has given me direction to engage in stakeholder discussions on this issue. And the preliminary step was to first consult with the governor's office on this matter. The guidance and really direction from the governor's office was to investigate what other boards, how they have addressed this issue. And in doing so, we have learned that the Arizona Medical Board, Board of Osteopathic Examiners, and also the Arizona Podiatry Board, they do have language within their own statutes that allow these boards to conduct investigations when there are allegations of unprofessional conduct. So setting aside a disagreement about the findings of the IMEs, it provides that narrow pathway when the complaint allegation is specific to unprofessional conduct. So I came back to the governor's office and reported that other boards have elected to address this matter in that fashion. And the governor's office received that well, but indicated that the next step was to meet with ASPA and to discuss this with that group, as if we were to propose legislation to introduce similar statutory language, we would need to make sure that ASPA was comfortable with us in doing so. So that's why Dr. Berry is remaining with us to have discussion.
Okay. And Dr. Berry, thanks for being here. Are there any concerns with us moving forward with changing the, adding that language that if professional conduct is an issue, we can look at this? I look at it.
Well, I've got a two-part answer to your question. First of all, the State Professional Association welcomes this addition to the statute, and we think that it's important that psychologists are not immune from unethical behavior related to court-related evaluations and testimony. The second part is that while I'm sure that everybody appreciates that IME is a shorthand that we all use for independent medical examinations. Indeed, we are not physicians, we are psychologists. We do independent psychological evaluations. One of our members who is also an attorney pointed out that there are a variety of different types of evaluations that are court related. And so he and I in particular would hope that we are able to use something, inclusive kinds of language that talks about court-ordered expert witness evaluations obtained as part of a legal case by any party. And that would include experts that are working directly for the court or on behalf of either plaintiffs or defendants in adjudicated matters. Obviously, many of us have also done lots of evaluations for insurance companies, workers' compensation and personal injury cases, for example, where we might work directly for the insurance company and never appear in court. These are forensic related kinds of evaluations and somehow should also be included under these regulations.
Okay. I think, isn't there currently some kind of clause, Ms. Galvin, where if you're a court appointed psychologist, there's some kind of an umbrella where you, it was some kind of protection there anyways already? trying to think.
Are you talking about like the claim process where there is that protection for court ordered evaluations and services? I don't know if Dr. Berry's talking about a psychologist who may not necessarily conduct a court ordered evaluation, but who testifies in court on behalf of a party, not necessarily court ordered.
Well, that's and correct.
If I may, I think the issue is also not just court ordered evaluations, but evaluations ordered by a state agency like the Industrial Commission.
Well, I think though that if you, the concern is if the psychologist does not do, is out of line, does an unprofessional job that is unprofessional, especially in the Industrial Commission, where is the accountability then, Dr. Berry, if the person is not, does a poor evaluation, does not meet the standards of the psychology association, where is the accountability?
Well, at the present time, there is immunity for psychologists who do an ethical, competent evaluation and or testimony, and is immune at that point from legal action by people who are unhappy with the outcome of that evaluation. What we're talking about is unethical behavior. And at this time, my understanding is that there is no, there are no consequences for that. And that's what we're looking to add to the statute. And we appreciate that.
And I think that's what I think we're looking at doing also. I think that because the end result's not the issue. I mean, the end result's, that professional opinion, it's the process or the behavior or something like that where the unethical behavior occurs. So with an IME, I think that we should mimic what the other boards have in their statute. It's already something that's been already a precedence in other statutes. And it appears to give enough leeway where if it's unprofessional behavior, we can look at it. Again, the end result isn't the issue, it's the behavior. And if there's not an issue, there's not an issue. Is there a concern with the language that's in the other statutes if we were to look at something like that?
The osteopathic board language is would be very acceptable to ASPA, with the exception, once again, of changing independent medical exam to independent psychological exam.
Okay. And do we have...
We're just looking at this very small area. Psychologists are responsible to the board in all other forensic matters. In the case of the IME, we have been thrown a curveball in having come up with cases where we felt there was clearly questionable behavior, but were stripped of our ability to intervene. And I think that making this change, especially in light of other boards having similar language, makes a heck of a lot of sense for us to be able to insert ourselves into a review of unethical practices and behaviors on the part of psychologists who heretofore have benefited from essentially a blanket immunity. And I don't know that that's interpretive, but I think it certainly makes a hell of a lot of sense to make a change in the statute so that it's very clear that this board is going to expect the same ethical behavior and procedures in IMEs that we do in all other areas of practice.
And Madam Chair, if I could interject, I mentioned this at the board meeting, but have yet to do so today. But what intrigued me too about the osteopathic medical boards approach is that they will send complaints of this nature to an independent reviewer to first ascertain if that this is really a case about a difference or disagreement in findings, or if there really are concerns relative to unprofessional conduct. So that's something that I think this board could to consider as another layer of evaluation.
And that the independent reviewer is a contracted person off the board. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Dr. Berry, what were your thoughts on that?
I think that's a really good idea. I think it might help mitigate inappropriate referrals for conduct that isn't unprofessional. It's just not to the liking of somebody.
Yeah, and I agree. But I think it's a nice balance of, I think I represent the general public, that the general public's best interests are served in case there was an issue. And yet I think having an independent look at it before it comes here, again, we don't want people to just be able to think, oh, they're not happy with the outcome, they're going to file a complaint. There needs to be some substance, definite stuff, substance to it. So,
Madam Chair, if I may, so I have two thoughts on the kind of independent person reviewing, you know, these things. One is my concern would be in ordering that independent evaluation, is the board financially on the line for paying for that independent evaluation? That would be my first concern. And my second concern would be that if sounds like the psychologist examiner's board is outsourcing some of its functions as a state agency to someone else. So we want to be careful with, you know, how that's being done.
Okay. The other option is handling it like we do the court complaints, and that is that it's sent to three board members independently, not knowing who else received it. The three board members have to review it, provide their thoughts, whether they feel that there's a issue with the complaint. And then is it two out of three, or does it have to be all three? I'm trying to remember, Heidi.
If any one,
it's only one.
One. So if one of them feels though that there is a concern, then it goes forward to the board. So we could look at an option like that, where maybe it's, you know, whether it's one or two or however the board feels that would be appropriate.
And Mr. Dinar, I know that with the osteo board, they have a long list of individuals who conduct these reviews for them, not only the IME cases, but other cases that the board's in-house medical consultant does not feel competent. If a cardiology case comes in, she refers to a cardiologist. And there are those outside medical consultants who will redo it, review those matters at a reduced rate. And I think since my tenure on this board, about 10 years, I think we've only had maybe two or three IME cases.
Yeah.
To the board. So it wouldn't be, in my opinion, a huge financial drain on the board, but obviously it is something we would have to consider.
Right. Yeah. And my understanding is there are other boards that occasionally have independent reviewers, and they have like a flat rate system for each case they review it. So it's not like an hourly rate. It's, you know, hey, you get X amount of dollars for reviewing one case that we assign to you.
Exactly.
So it's not like a open-ended financial burden, you know, it's something predictable and manageable on our end.
Correct. Madam Chairman, I noticed Dr. Diana Davis-Wilson has joined the call.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Wilson, are you here as an observer?
I can be, yes, whatever you prefer. I ended up on another phone call and had to join late.
Okay, because 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If you were here as a committee member, we cannot have more than 5 because now we have a quorum of the board.
Oh, then I am happy to, Dr. Davies on the call, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Then I am happy to remove myself.
All right. We will miss you, but we
are free to attend and listen and ask questions as a member of the public. But I would ask that you refrain from, you know, voting on any matter.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Or you can step off. Whatever you want to do is it works.
Thank you.
All right. So, am I feeling a consensus that we want to move forward and take this? Do we need to take it to the whole board with the idea of maybe following the path of the other board that has, you know, the language that we feel is appropriate?
Madam Chair, there's one piece of due diligence that I think I would want to do, and that's just for me to circle back to the governor's office, to the policy advisors that I've been meeting with, and let them know that we do have ASVA support to move forward with the legislative change that would emulate the language in the other the medical board statutes. There, it may be that they also want us to have some exchange with the Industrial Commission. So I'll immediately after this meeting, I'll do that follow up. And then I think this could appear on the next board agenda, at least for purposes of an update.
Okay. Is everybody
I would put that in terms of a motion.
Okay. So we got a motion.
That motion.
Is it?
That we direct the executive director to follow through the governor's office, as well as touch base with the Industrial Commission and with their sign off that we move this to the full board.
Okay, so we have a motion. Any discussion?
Second.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Dr. Mr. Diner. We got a motion and a second. Jumping ahead of myself. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Again, Dr. Berry, thanks for being part of this discussion with us.
Thank you for having me.
And moving to item number, is there any other? There's an issue of others. Is there any other going to the legislature? Heidi, we need to talk about?
Madam Chair, I only listed that on the agenda in case something else developed that we would want to talk about just to cover our bases. I don't have anything.
Okay. All right, moving to item six then, discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning the draft proposed revisions of AAC Title IV, Chapter 26, Board of Psychology Examiners. Those are the rules. And then go ahead, Heidi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, just to jump ahead of you. So while Jennifer is teeing this up, I had intended to share the draft to walk through it with you. My Word has crashed, and in order for me to restore it, I have to reboot this computer and leave the meeting. So what I've arranged is for Jennifer to pull up the Word document with the markups, and then she will, together we will work through it. She will drive and I will co-pilot or something to that effect. So let's give her a moment to pull up the draft. While she's doing that, I do want to indicate too that we are only looking at some proposed draft revisions to the psychologist rules at this time. Sort of on a parallel track, the Committee on Behavior Analysts, they are planning a meeting early in 2021 to review their rules along with their stakeholders, primary stakeholder groups. So I think that Dr. Davy and I will pay close attention to this discussion because there could be some instances with the behavior analyst rules where we would want to mirror what this board is considering.
Hold on 1 second.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can see it.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Jennifer, I think what will work well is that if you go to the review tab of Word, and then we will just navigate through the markups by clicking next. I think that will work. Okay. So I will just describe my thoughts, where the genesis of these proposed edits, if you will. But I invite anyone to sort of question or jump in with your comments, and also to me if you see anything that I may have missed. But generally what I've done is I've tried to capture comments that are, or edits that the board has discussed previously. So in this instance, I'm going to have to look at my big screen, hold on. Jennifer, is there any way you could make that document a little bit bigger?
Mm-hmm. Amen.
It's not just me and my Mr. Magoo spectacles today.
Let me know when to stop.
Okay.
That looks good.
Yeah.
Okay. So this edit should have, yes, yeah, struck all. This is anticipating that the board's the board has discussed modifying the statute 32-20-81 so that it's clear that there are that there's when information presents where the safety and well-being of the public is at imminent risk, rather than going taking the complaint to the complaint screening committee and then to the board, we can circumvent the complaint screening committee and go directly to the board for possible emergency action. So this deletion would address that change.
All right. Then I would ask, as we go along, if there's any concerns with these, let's talk about it. And because if the idea is if we're good with them, we'll take this to the whole board. All right.
Do we as a committee need to vote yes or no on the changes in bulk or separately?
I think it would be fine to do them in bulk unless there's a discussion or disagreement about a change that Heidi has proposed.
Sounds good to me.
Good question. Thank you.
So hearing no comments on this, we can probably go to the next one. Very good. This proposed change considers the fact that applicants, of course, pay a fee of $350 when filing an application for an initial licensure with this board. However, the board has in the past been interested and committed to allowing applicants for licensure to apply through ASPPB's PLUS system. The PLUS system essentially acts as a credentials bank and does perform appropriate primary source verification of the documents that we require primary source verification. So, at points in the past, this board has indicated when we can move forward with allowing applicants to apply through PLUS, we want to be able to do so. However, the fee for applying to PLUS that is paid to PPB is $200. So in essence, we could be imposing a fee, a double fee on applicants. So I am proposing that in the instance where an applicant decides to go directly to PLUS, that we are able to split the fee with ASPPB, rather than, again, double up the fee, $350 to this board, $200 to ASPPB. So questions or comments about that?
Madam Chair, if I may. So I like the idea. My question would be how the accounting treatment works for something like this. So is it the case that the fee, so when, like, let's say I'm applying through the PLUS system, when I put in my credit card information, am I paying to ASPPB and then they are sharing $150 with us? Or is it that they are, when I put in my credit card information, they're paying to us, the board, and then the board is reimbursing the PLUS system for the $200?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Diner. Good questions. So what I appreciate about ASPPB is that they have different payment models that we could follow. So we could collect all of the fee and then, you know, forward the $200 to ASPPB. Or, you know, we could be invoiced by ASPPB. There's different approaches. ASPPB is entirely flexible. What I'm trying to do right now, and I wish that I had this clarity, but I don't yet, I've contacted the General Accounting Office and also the governor's office on strategic planning and budgeting to ascertain what legally is the appropriate path for us to follow when, you know, we're talking about sort of a revenue share kind of arrangement. So I'm trying to navigate that. Whatever they tell me is appropriate, that's the process we will follow. But the good news is that ASPPB can work with us in whatever fashion we need to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I may, that makes sense. My concern would be, one type of accounting treatment might potentially trigger some kind of procurement rules for, you know, government contracting, whereas the other one would be slightly different. So I would encourage, you know, you to have that conversation with the governor's office and see, you know, and maybe it might be the case that based on that discussion, we might need to tweak this language a little bit, because sharing fees, the way it's written right now, kind of gives rise to like a few possibilities in my mind. So we might want to have like additional clarity from the governor's office and the accounting administration office before we can, you know, maybe put the language in, set the language in stone, so to speak, in the rules.
Agreed.
Yes, indeed. What I want to believe is that what we are
turned off, it won't. So it's
Zoom. This isn't the only this isn't the only instance where this issue has presented. So hopefully there is guidance out there, some language that we can
disabled in a chair. I can't get to it.
Dr. Bob, is your mic on? Were you saying something?
Correct.
Dr. Bob?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. All right. We just heard some talking. Wasn't sure if you were trying to say something. Okay. Sorry.
So if there are no other questions or comments about this this concept, even if the language is less than perfect.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So one question I would have is, if we are cutting our fee in more than half, how will that impact the financial situation of the board if this application approach kind of takes on and is used frequently?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Meyer, for the question. Essentially, because the board's fund balance is so healthy and robust, we really can afford to incur some instances where an applicant may elect to go this route. We have about 170, 175 initial applications on an annual basis. If even 20% of the applicants elect to go through this process, the lost revenue really is minimal. Our fund balance keeps growing beyond what the agency is expending, spending year to year. So we can absorb this fairly easily. And it does, by shifting the process to ASPPB to some degree as well, it decreases our labor costs, of course, you know, on our end. So there is sort of dynamic where we could realize some financial savings to our expenses in the process.
Thank you.
Okay, if there aren't any other questions or comments, we can go to the next set. So under B, we're still in the fees section of the rules, B1 through 4. These are fees that I'm sure have been in place for many years. What board staff has struggled with these very tiny fees is that it really costs more for us to process the fees received, the revenue received, than we are, you know, realizing a financial gain. And in other words, it costs more to perform these functions than what the fees cover. So these are all instances where we can easily supply this information to the requester, and it's becoming difficult. It's so easy to transmit this information electronically that it really doesn't justify what we're even, the fee that we are levying to the requester. So we're proposing to do away with these fees entirely. The alternative would be to fees in order to cover the cost of staff's labor to process the fees, but that seems sort of self-defeating, or I'm not sure if that's an apt description, but it doesn't make sense to us to increase the fees just because it costs us X amount of dollars to, you know, handle a check, to prepare a deposit, and so forth. So eliminating these fees, the staff is entirely on board with processing these services with no fee charged in the process.
I like it. I like also how it gives you authority to waive. So there's that flexibility.
Yes. In instance where a directory is requested, we think that it's appropriate for in certain instances where, you know, that information will be used for non-commercial purposes. Maybe it would be used for to contact psychologists who want to sort of, you know, meet to form some sort of a group or, you know, it would be different if we were talking about instances where a continuing education development company wants the, you know, to market their courses to us. That's clearly a commercial purpose. And so, you know, charging the fee for those public records makes sense. But we have had instances where individuals have indicated, you know, they want to have the address of public record to reach out to colleagues for various reasons. So those are the waivers described in the new sections 1, 2, 3, and 4.
I'm fine with dropping them.
Excellent. And then the new number 5, we are highly discouraging respondents to we're discouraging them from requesting copies of their investigative record in hard copy format. The cost, of course, can be astronomical if we were to charge the reproduction fee per page, you know, when the cases are thousands and thousands of pages. So for a mere $25, we think that that is a reasonable fee and covers our cost to prepare and transmit an electronic copy of the file to the respondent.
Sounds good.
Yep, sounds good.
Heidi, excellent. I would just note the digital copy of the investigative record.
Oh, thank you. Yes, thanks for catching my typo. I'll make note of them. Okay.
Can I just ask it?
Okay.
Heidi?
Yes.
Just one related costs. You say $25 more than covers the fee. When you look at your staff's, you know, hourly rate, when you kind of take down their salary, you're still confident that $25 covers that and the amount of time it requires them to complete this process?
Yes, Dr. Davey, thank you for asking the question. By the point in time that they would be eligible to request the file, it's been prepared already for review. So this would mostly consist of providing any, you know, updates from the respondent, choosing what media format it would be sent. It might be, you know, a flash drive. It might be sent as a Google Drive. So really this is Jennifer's time to assemble what has already been assembled, update it if necessary, and transmit it to the requester.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, if we're ready to move on. Pass the fees, thanks, Jennifer. the next one. So we've had some discussion about, let's see, telepractice. Okay, I think my comment to this one is simply that we've talked, I've heard the board talk in recent months about ensuring that the rules are accommodating of the new practice realities that COVID-19 has introduced to the practice of psychology. And so I didn't have anything specific here, but wanted to ensure that there was opportunity to discuss anything in this rule that this committee wants to raise.
My concern is that we continue this throughout COVID and look at continuing it after.
Thank you, Dr. Bohansky. I'm certain that anything in particular in this rule presented any sort of restriction that you would consider lifting. I defer to, you know, your expertise if you see language in R426-109 that you think is too restrictive.
Can we go down a little bit more?
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Meyer.
So the one aspect is under supervision. I don't see an issue with the telepractice, but under 111 for supervision, you've already changed the visual requirement for supervision, but we still have the limit of 50% of supervision. And I think that that's the one aspect that we also need to consider changing, both for dealing with COVID-19 as well as more broadly addressing rule demands and issues.
Yeah, the governor's order has got that frozen right now, but I certainly agree. That was Dr. Meyer. That should be dropped completely.
So what, as I was sort of looking through all of this material last night and then again this morning, I think that we do have a potential issue that we need to talk about relative to sort of lifting these changes or restrictions in R426-111. I think we need to look at the statute 32-2071 at subsections F and G. Jennifer, are you able to do that for us?
Which rule, Heidi? I'm sorry.
Go to statute 32-2071.
Hold on. Hold on 1 second and stop sharing.
Okay.
Okay, can you see the statute information? I'll zoom in.
But. Yeah, it's the first instance of language that I think we need to talk about. And again, we're looking at statute. So 32-2071, subsection F6.
Which one, Heidi?
F, then 6. I know this is the longest statute, I think, in the history of statutes.
Oh, too far.
Let's see. Okay, here's F. So I see that, do you see the language where as of January or 2016, hold on, I'm looking on my bigger screen where I can actually see, beginning July 1, 2016, not more than 50% of the in-person supervision may be completed using telepractice supervision as specified by the board by rule. So what's curious to me is that at least how I understand statutory language and rule construct is you wouldn't typically see a restriction like this in the statute. You would restrictive language in the rule and just sort of, you know, the language in the statute should generally authorize something. So when I stumbled across this quite accidentally last night and took another look at it this morning, I thought, this could be problematic in making what is otherwise a simple rule language change. So if I could make a recommendation, and again, this is to statute, maybe striking that sentence would be first necessary before we are able to make the rule change. Ms. Galvin, would you agree we can't make the rule change without eliminating this restriction in the statute?
Yes, we cannot make the rule change in accordance with what Dr. Bohansky proposed with that statute in place. You would have to strike that.
And that's going to be an issue again in subsection G5. So a little further down in this statute, G5 has the same language. I don't, of course, know the history of that language, but maybe as the first foray into supervision by telepractice, that that restriction was appropriate at that time. I don't know.
I think I was there then. I mean, I think the concern was you didn't want to have someone being supervised, I mean, more than 50% over a Zoom, because you can't exactly see the whole conversation, the body language. And so, I mean, I think at the time there was concern whether they would be a, you know, good supervisor role based on the information they would receive over a computer. I remember the discussion and the reasoning. But at the time, this, you know, Zoom, all this was kind of more of a, you know, sometimes was used as opposed to being part of your daily life.
Yeah, I think it was a reaction to the change in technology and how we do this. But
it was it not before, did it not only allow for like 25% of the time? And so we upped it to 50?
Correct.
Yeah.
In recognition of, and I think the date was put in there because we were trying to anticipate the effective date of the rules and give everybody kind of, you know, notice that this was happening.
Right.
But I think the way that the statute refers back to the rule seems odd, doesn't it? I mean, with that in there, that it's as specified by the board by rule, can we change the rule and that be sufficient?
No.
So since we have a possible bill, if we're permitted to introduce it and we can secure a sponsor, which we're actively working on, my suggestion would be we propose striking in both subsections that sentence that's beginning July 1, 2016, and just let the rule language speak for itself.
How long would it take the rule to go through, though?
Oh, we can get a statute change, assuming this is a typical legislative session. The statute change would definitely precede the rule change, so that's not a concern.
No, my, I guess my concern though is if there's not any parameters, then does that allow, is there concern if it's 100%? Is there concern if the supervision's 100% if there's no parameters?
I see.
It, I mean, it can't because of the statute limits it.
Well, I know, but we're talking about taking this out of the statute, putting it in a rule, but there's this gap between point A and point B where then there's no definition of how much time can be on a Zoom or over this type of visual media.
As part of it, go ahead.
I think that's where we're at, that the field is shifting to removing those limitations on telepsychology, that this is regardless of pandemics, we're moving to this. And so this limiting to a certain amount of telepractice is an outdated thought.
But it's providing supervision through telepractice. It's not telepractice. It's the right. Supervising hour. Well, so
supervision falls under telepractice. And I would argue that providing therapy over telepractice is more challenging and more important to focus on than the practice of supervision over telepsychology.
I would suggest leaving the language in about the, it has to be under a secure network. I think when this came up, everybody was using Skype, if I recall right. And it, you know, there was concerns whether it's secure or not and people can, but I think there needs to be language that whatever you telepractice, it needs to be under a secure system.
Absolutely. But that it, for that, we're just getting rid of the word visual.
Okay.
So that it can, because this has always been a problem that for example, if my supervisee is dealing with a suicidal issue in a client, they're going to call me on the phone immediately. And that's based on these rules, that's not a legitimate way to practice supervision if it's just over the phone. And so but that would still be specified in our rules. We're just getting rid of the word visual, not that it's conducted using secure, confidential, real-time communication.
All right. Thanks for clarifying.
And we could add to that statute any other language that you think would be helpful that maybe would not require us to go through the rulemaking process, that, you know, supervision may be, or telesupervision may be practiced or conducted any percentage of the supervision. So we go.
Right. I think we could just get rid of number one, that we're not setting a limit on how much of the supervision is done through telepractice, and then just striking visual from number two.
All right. And that might be an easier fix, because if you go to the rulemaking process, it's a lot longer.
Well, no, I thought we were talking about striking the whole sentence in the statute and then just modifying the rules.
Right.
Right. You might also seek an exemption in the statute when you go to amend it that would be put in session law that would exempt the board from having to go through the regular rulemaking process, and you could just basically publish the rules without the formal rulemaking process. And that's something that could be explored when you amend the statute.
Excellent.
Madam Chair, if I may, I agree with everything that has been said so far. So Ms. Packinen or Ms. Galvin, remind me of the subjects for the proposed statutory changes. I believe it was the Argosy fix and there was something else. And the reason I ask that is because if we are contemplating any rulemaking after those statutory changes are made, my concern would be that getting an exemption from a for like a speedier rule change procedure for only the supervision telepractice issue might raise kind of a few questions from the legislators at that point. So if we want to include the supervision telepractice in kind of this, you know, every kind of conforming change with the psychologist statutes, then we might want to think through how exactly to get that accomplished.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Diner, you raise a good point. So the collection of changes that the board thus far has discussed and approved include the fingerprint card requirement for initial licensure, renewal of licensure for both professions. For the behavior analyst, the requirement that supervision provided for purposes of meeting the requirements for licensure, the supervisor must be licensed in the state in which they are providing the supervision if licensure exists in the state. The Argosy fix, if you will, that was a session law piece. And then more recently, what the board has approved is clarifying what I mentioned earlier relative to cases that need to be expedited before the board for possible summary suspension. And the IME issue, which may or may not be ready to move forward in this session. It's possible, but I'm not certain.
Thank you, Ms. Packen. So my concern there would be that, I mean, my personal opinion is I think it doesn't run into problems with the single subject rule. So our constitution requires only a bill have only a single subject. But I mean, all of these separate kind of discrete issues are related to the Board of Psychologists Examiners. So my personal opinion is, you know, we can include everything in one bill, but if that question comes up, which I can imagine at least one legislator raising that question, so we at least need to be prepared to address that at that level. So, I mean, you know, preparation is, in that sense, is better than being blindsided by a question like that. So that would kind of be my thought or suggestion.
Yes, indeed. I do trust that when we secure sponsorship, and then of course we are our folder is opened and we're contacted by legislative council staff, they ascertain what is the best course of action. And maybe it's, as you say, an omnibus bill is perfectly acceptable, but yes, we need to be prepared for whatever possibilities that, you know, we need that are appropriate.
All right, any other discussion? All right, moving on, are there other suggestions?
Yes, Madam Chair. So there are the next rule, R426-207, continuing education. There are some suggestions in here that are maybe somewhat presumptive part. I think they at least somewhat reflect some recent board discussions relative to jurisprudence. My charge most recently was to investigate different strategies for how to impart jurisprudence knowledge on our licensees. And so that process is happening. We may at some point in time want to have a specific carve out for continuing education, however, for credit, jurisprudence for credit.
Yeah, I like these additions. I think that we over and over see the issue that the psychologist doesn't know what the rules or the statutes are for psychology. And so I like the way you've included these here.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I skipped over one in R426-206. Can we back up just a little bit? It seems that, and I think most of this group remembers that the domestic violence, intimate partner abuse, child abuse, or abuse of vulnerable adults requirement of, I believe it, 4 hours. Our rule used to state that 4 hours of the continuing education requirements must be in these topics, but that was eliminated with the effective date of July 4th of this year. However, we did not catch the fact that in R-426-206, which is reinstatement of license, we still have this specific carve out. So I think it would be consistent with the board's intent to eliminate it. But if this committee and ultimately the board feels like, hey, you're reinstating a license, you should still have to complete continuing education coursework in these content areas, then we need to just update the citation or clarify that. So I hope that makes sense. In other words, are we eliminating this requirement for reinstatement because we eliminated it for renewal, or do we intend to keep it here?
I think the intent was to eliminate this as a requirement so that it should be also stricken from this rule.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. That was my hunch, but I didn't want to be presumptive. I think that just with the most recent rulemaking that this eluded us somehow. So going back to continuing education, if you scroll to subsection F, I think it is, Jennifer, the there has been some discussion of the standards for continuing education must be met. I don't know if this board is ready to adopt a specific set of standards beyond that which you already have in the rule. It's pretty minimal right now in our rule. And so we know that by virtue of the fact that most of the continuing education courses that licensees, psychologist licensees complete, most of it is APA accredited. Krishna did do some follow-up research as the board had directed, and it's at least 80% or more of the CE completed is AP-accredited CE. So do we want to raise the standards, acknowledge the APA standards? What do we want to do here?
Are we talking about the jurisprudence?
Sorry, Dr. Meyer, no. The standards for any and all continuing education. So that's subsection F.
Can you move to F, please?
Jennifer, I didn't give you good direction.
Okay. Before we go on, can we go back to the jurisprudence?
Sure.
Okay. Sorry, Jennifer. Back up.
Okay. So, I know that the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners includes a 2-hour requirement for jurisprudence. Is that what we're looking to model?
Yes, Dr. Meyer, exactly that. So rather than imposing or layering a new requirement on top of what's already required, just creating within those 40 required units a requirement that's specific to jurisprudence. And so we're not, in the process, we're not imposing any extra cost or time on the part of the licensees.
Okay.
And so what will ultimately meet this requirement has yet to be determined by the board.
Okay.
And so we would, I'm just looking for clarification, the board would have to approve each course. What does as approved by the board mean?
That's a placeholder, at least in my mind, until the board decides what direction to go in. If the board is willing to consider APA accredited jurisprudence courses, if they're willing to, you know, entertain from ASPA, an ASPA developed course, if the board decides to do some sort of an online, you know, learning module, that's yet to be determined.
Well, I think it needs to be based on our jurisprudence or our specific rules and statutes. Do you know how, and that it's the same thing for everyone. Do you know how the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners developed theirs?
We have only done a cursory investigation into what their module looks like. Jennifer actually located it fairly recently on their website. What it appears to me to be is that it is, you know, probably something that was developed with sort of a national influence, and it may be sort of something that's shared with other jurisdictions as well.
No, it's specific to the rules and statutes for Arizona.
Correct.
So it's not national. It just applies to Arizona licensure.
Correct. It may have been, the board may have contracted with an independent vendor that is a national organization who has experience in developing assessment tools for jurisdictions.
Okay.
So essentially the model that I am, ultimately I would love to see this board adopt is similar to what the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy did, whereby they provide our board with the psychometric expertise and services, the item bank hosting capabilities, maybe the delivery platform, whatever resources they have. And so we contract with them, but the content is, and the content outline, the blueprint for the assessment tool comes specifically from our statutes and rules.
Okay. And any idea, so we would develop that, or we would have that developed. Any idea on what the cost would be for that or the timeline?
Yes. So that proposal is currently, a proposal is being developed as we speak. So it's something that the board may get to take a look at as early as the January meeting. And again, that's just one strategy. That's, I've been very outspoken. It's my favorite strategy if it's one that is affordable. The other strategy, of course, is continuing education courses. So this board would be presented with, you know, different options, vendors who present a jurisprudence course, and the board can determine whether or not they're appropriate.
Is the cost within the realm that we can handle as a board? I guess that was, I think Dr. Meyer was asking that kind of a general cost.
Well, that's yet to be determined. Physical therapy they were able to do these modules very inexpensively, very inexpensive cost to the taker.
Heidi, you have.
So we may be looking at higher costs.
Heidi, you froze. We didn't hear any of that.
Yeah, we can hear you now.
You can hear me now?
Yeah.
I don't know what the proposal is going to look like. What I've asked Matt at ASPPB to do is to price it out, assuming that there would be some potential investment on the part of the board to launch the tool, and that we keep the cost to the candidate or the cost to the taker low. So it may be that we can price it as low as $25. It may be $40, $45. That's the range that I think we would be potentially looking at.
I just have a question. It seems to me, in listening to the discussion, are we kind of conflating an exam with CE? It sounds like I'm kind of hearing bits and pieces of a jurisprudence exam versus what the rule says under continuing education.
No. So to me, it makes sense to model this very similarly to the Board of Behavioral Health, where there's no charge for it. I don't know how it was developed. I just took it a week ago. Yeah, because I'm licensed as a substance abuse counselor also, and so had to take that. But it's you review the rules and statutes, and then you answer questions to demonstrate your understanding and knowledge, just like a continuing education program does. And so I don't think it needs to be any more complicated than that. I just don't know what kind of and it doesn't really have to be a comprehensive psychometric evaluation or development for it. It really can be developed where it's we're develop a set of questions and you have to answer a random sample of those questions to demonstrate understanding, just like lots of CEUs programs offer. But I think that it needs to be the same program that's based specifically on our rules and statutes, and it's not going out and finding some CEU program that we don't know the accuracy of or that we don't have to mess with going through and approving or reviewing those, that it's just a single 2-credit course that all psychologists are required to take.
Like a home study course they do on their own.
Yep, so exactly.
Along the lines of what Dr. Meyer was mentioning, the analogy that comes to mind is the 4-hour professionalism course that newly licensed attorneys in Arizona have to take, and it counts towards the continuing legal education credits for the year. So it's kind of like a mixture of an exam and a continuing education, if you will. Okay. But it does count towards CE, and that's the kind of best analogy I can think of.
That's good. So are we okay, Dr. Myers and Mr. Diner, with the language that's proposed right here in front of us?
Well, yeah, I think it's not, rather than approved by the board, it's offered by the board. So that it's okay. A single course offered by us that everyone takes.
Okay. I that's fine. Is everybody okay with that wording?
Yeah, we would just have to look into if there's any fee involved. You have to have statutory authority to collect that fee.
And the Board of Behavioral Health does not charge for it. So I think that would be the next step, is to talk with them on how it was developed and implemented.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dr. Meyer. There's clearly a model that's working for them. And so my hunch is that the board invested into the cost of developing, maintaining, and delivering that particular learning module. And we would need to understand what that might look like for us. Again, they have volume on their side, we don't. And so that's a factor. And Ms. Galvin, you asked earlier about, you know, if this is an examination, I think we could define this as an examination. The board has statutory authority to require an additional examination beyond the ECCC. But I guess what I'm recommending is something that's like what Mr. Diner was describing. It's a learning module. It's a learning tool. If you want to call it an assessment, you can. But it's framed as continuing education and meeting specific continuing education requirements.
And that's fine. However you want to frame it. I just wouldn't want to frame it as an exam that's required when it's under continuing education.
Yeah. The questions you answer are to simply demonstrate that you reviewed and understand the merit material. So it's continuing education, not a jurisprudence exam.
Yes, and the literature supports this approach as highly effective for knowledge retention. So again, the emphasis is learning. It's not a high stakes examination. It's not a barrier to, you know, can you keep your license? Do you lose your license sort of thing? You can take it multiple times until you master the content. So that's the approach I'm advocating.
Right.
All right.
The Another continuing education topic that I want to throw out there is there's a big push in the field of psychology at this point to focus more on multicultural competency and advocate for social justice. I know that AZPA is, at least the multicultural committee is pushing for an addition of requirement in the continuing education for multicultural competency. And that's seen in many other state board requirements and related behavioral health fields as well. And I'm wondering if that is something that we should be considering.
No, absolutely not.
I agree with Dr. Bohansky.
Can I have a bit more on that? Why absolutely not?
I don't believe it's the role of AZAPA or APA or the Board of Psychology Examiners to stick its finger in the social justice issue.
Not social. Sorry, I probably shouldn't have said social justice.
Or I'm multicultural.
Focusing on multicultural competency, which is part of our ethics code.
It's already there in the ethics code, period.
Okay. I think this is an incredibly important topic. Is this something that we could discuss at the board level?
I think we could talk about it at the board level. I think we obviously have some opinions here. I don't have really an opinion either way, as far as I'm not that with regards to the topic. Do I need the boards of this committee's approval to take it to the board, Ms. Galvin, or is that an issue we can just?
No, you're the chair of this committee and chair of the board, so you can put it on a future agenda and have a discussion.
Okay. I think it's worth, let's have a discussion and see what the other board members feel.
Thank you.
So if we're ready to circle back to the discussion about the standards, and I guess before we...
Heidi, can I ask a question that just for the sake of the board's understanding of where things stand, as part of that agenda topic for the board, I think to Dr. Mahansky's point, you know, making sure we outline what the current... certification or licensure rules already have in place for specific CEUs, you know, in ethics or in multicultural competency, that'd probably be helpful in terms of the conversation.
Right, because I think it's a choice. I mean, someone could take that CEU if that's what they want. I mean, good discussion. Mm-hmm. All right, go ahead.
So with respect to the standards, I guess I kind of want to take a step back too and sort of share with this committee with the work that I did for a number of years in continuing competence with physical therapy. I do see that there is a whole lot of opportunity, as I see it, opportunity to make revisions to the CE rules in general to more... more consistently align with or emulate what research is telling us in the area of continuing competence. That's a big discussion. That's a very big effort to undertake. So I don't think we're prepared quite yet to do that. Maybe I'm wrong, but the first step in sort of doing what I would consider a comprehensive reform of continuing education to continuing competence, to shift to continuing competence, the first step is to talk about the standards that you require for continuing education activities. So if we're going to make some incremental progress right here, right now, I would ask the board to take a look at this issue of the standards that you establish for continuing education activities. And then we'll have a springboard from which we could move on to make other changes in the future. The standards are just in that section, subsection F. They're pretty minimal. They don't talk about evidence-based practice. They don't talk about evaluation of the activities. They don't talk about engagement, measurable objectives. There's a whole lot of standards that are missing there's a whole lot of opportunities to establish standards here in subsection F. Maybe we want to look at standards by the APA's accreditation group.
Which are all covered if we have APA accredited CEs.
So your concern is this, when you talk about standards, you're talking about the standard of the actual course provided.
Correct. Or the provider. There are two different approaches to accreditation.
Right. Yeah.
The course or the providers. APA, I believe, accredits providers.
And by limiting it to APA, are we then, is that like a sole, I mean, are we doing like, I think procurement, like a sole contract, or are we saying there's no one else that can provide those services? Is that giving someone a heads up on a bunch of financial, you know, we're leading them all to, you know, we're leading our psychologists to them. Is there concerns about there? Are there other people in the playing field? I guess those are questions I'd want to ask.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The way that physical therapy dealt with this issue is they would recognize an established set of standards. In this case, it could be the APA's, but anyone else who could demonstrate that they met those standards, even if they aren't APA accredited for whatever reason, as long as they provide evidence to this board that they still meet those standards, that's another, that's a more inclusive approach.
Okay. All right, so there is an option for, there is a way for another group or, you know, for someone to join in.
Correct.
Are we seeing an issue with the continuing education courses that psychologists are submitting?
Dr. Meyer, I'm not sure that we are. Not having the history with this board that I wish that I had, I really can't speak to that. I do think that I would like to see this board sort of make more of this shift to a continuing competence approach rather than just sort of, I mean, we know that sitting in a continuing education course doesn't make anybody any more competent than when they walked into the course. So we may not have a problem necessarily, but I'd really like for us to, you know, sort of move in this direction, beginning with the standards.
I like the idea. I think it's worth a discussion. I think maybe something we want to talk about it with the whole board. If this board feels like the discussion, you know, feels comfortable with the concept, move it to the full board to get their thoughts on it. Are there any concerns with that?
Well, I think a further discussion would be good. I don't know that I necessarily agree with us locking into just APA standards. But I agree that there could be more focus on competent or legitimate programs. I've seen some really, the concern I have is I've seen some incredibly poor courses that are APA accredited. And so just slapping on APA accreditation requirements, I don't think address the issues that that we may want to address.
Okay. And Heidi, can you share too, when we have a further discussion, a copy of the ADA APA requirements?
Yes, Madam Chair, I certainly will. I think that what some professions have to their advantage is there's sort of this accepted gold standard of a set of standards for continuing education. For psychology, it may or may not be APA's standards. I don't know, but in the case of, you know, physical therapy and other professions, the regulators and the professionals came together and agreed upon a set of collective set of standards. We may not have that benefit here with psychology. So,
yes, you do with COA.
And COA is Dr. Bohansky.
It's the Committee on Accreditation. Which is the subgroup independent of APA that accredits internship programs and accredits CE providers.
And that's Dr. Tony Minetti's group?
I don't know who's in charge of it nationally now.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So are we, do you want to then, no, let's keep going because I think we'll move the whole thing to the board anyways. I got about 10 more minutes. I need to, then I have to leave.
And I think we can cover the rest of it in 10 minutes. The next, if we jump to the next set of edits, it's all the way to, I believe, R426210. Yes, so this is the language that this board has talked about specific to the written training plans, the expectations for what the postdoctoral experience written training plans must consist of. So you tried to or considered a substantive policy statement most recently. And then as I was working through these rules, I realized, hey, there's an opportunity to outline the expectations that you want here in the rule.
Good idea.
Dr. Meyer, does this make sense?
Yes, I'm trying to see, does this also address the need to remain under supervision once the minimum required hours for licensure has been met?
Good point.
Right.
Yeah, we want to make sure we add that.
I agree. I don't think this language goes quite far. So I'll capture that comment.
Yeah. Yeah, good catch, Dr. Meyer. Mm-hmm.
I thought, Heidi, you had discussed drafting a separate section of rule to address that issue.
And it Ms. Galvin, it may be that it needs to be separated. What I found was that the written training plan requirements are outlined under the other training opportunities. So the pre-internship above in A3, it lists the requirements. So that's why I decided to put it here.
But if we're going to open up a legislative bill, I would rather see it in a statute than a rule. If we're all in agreement that even though you have met your hours, you still need to be under someone's supervision and you're not basically a quasi psychologist on your own. I mean, Ms. Galvin, do you see one over the other more where it should be?
I think that setting forth the standards of what should be in a written training plan is not the best place to ensure that those who completed their hours remain under supervision. And I do think the best place would probably be the statute.
So could we just add a section in here like a DE or some other, you know, someplace in the statute regarding this issue?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that would need to be added to our list of possible legislative changes. So I'll make sure that it's incorporated in that collection for the board's next review.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think it's a public health issue. You know, I just think it's so, yeah, if you could add that into the list, that would be great.
Sure.
If everyone agrees, is there anyone that has a different opinion? All right, not hearing any.
And then on the written training plan, it talks about total numbers. For client contact and supervision, but it doesn't say what those requirements are. It seems like we would either want to specify in accordance with our requirements, or that might not be necessary.
Dr. Meyer, I don't see that specified, like for the pre-internship professional experience training.
So a minimum of 40% of the total hours have to be direct client contact. So it seems like we should just say that as opposed to just document the number of hours.
If there is a requirement, yeah, it should probably be in there.
And same with the minimum required amount of supervision per week.
And Dr. Meyer, I'm sorry, this is a reflection of my ignorance. Are those requirements clearly outlined in statute? I am not certain about that.
Is it statute or rules? Let me...
And I can do that research offline if needed, because it...
Yeah, to me, I think it would be better to... We could either leave off, like, E, F, and G, or provide those specific requirements in there.
Okay.
Because they are outlined elsewhere, so I don't know that needs to be reiterated, because if they don't meet those minimum requirements for supervision and client contact, then it's not, those hours aren't going to be approved anyway.
Right.
So this was more about just providing the content and quality of what a training plan should be.
Sure.
But postdoctoral professional experience is occurring that includes at least the following. If they have to have a certain percentage, I think it should be in the statute here.
Well, these are rules, right? So.
Oh, yeah. These rules. Okay, sorry. All right, you're right.
I'm going to research the statute.
This is this. It's sitting right there under C.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
For client contact, and then we also need the supervision. Yeah, so I don't think it needs to be repeated for this.
Okay.
So it'd be E, F, and G, I think is sufficiently addressed elsewhere.
Okay, very good. So if there's nothing else under this rule, I have just one more thought to present, which is, as I understand it, in R426.301, that's where you incorporate by reference the specific code of ethics, APA's ethical principles of psychologists and code of conduct. I know you made a deliberate decision at some point in the past, or maybe multiple decisions, to remain with this version of the code and not move to more current versions. Since we're opening the rules and talking about them, are there any thoughts about updating the reference to more current code of ethics?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not, meaning let's do it. I
absolutely not. We stay with what we've got.
Why?
Because I agree with the current code of ethics.
So we're not agreeing with the updated code of ethics?
Correct.
How come?
That's why you have so many military psychologists licensed in Arizona.
But that doesn't answer. I just need to understand a little more. It seems to me logically you would go with the more updated rules. So I'm just trying to a code of ethics. What do you mean, Dr. Bob?
It's a very long story, which involves a multitude of reports, the resignation of most of APA over it, and it's a hot button issue. Arizona is one of the few states that has supported our military and the military chain of command, and that gets undercut by the current code of ethics. I'm unwilling to see that change occur.
All right, can we put this on a board?
I mean, I would have to say that we should be practicing according to the current agreed upon standard of ethics, which includes not allowing for torture. So I think we should be going with the most current agreed upon ethics.
And Madam Chair, if I may interject, I'm happy to have a conversation with Dr. Bob to understand this issue. A statute has been called to my attention fairly recently, which may bring, which may ensure that if you were trained through the military, you are on par with anyone who was trained in a non-military program. But this warrants more discussion, clearly.
I just think as a group, we need to all understand, why. I mean, I'm just open to the conversation. I just want to make sure that we are, that a conscious decision is made when a new one comes out, that we decide not to take it or to take it. I mean, that way it doesn't look like we're back in 2003 and we haven't thought about it. So let's put it on an agenda and talk about it.
Thought about it very clearly.
All right. And then that's what I'd like to hear, Dr. Bob. Let's talk about the issues.
And Heidi, I think we can, help gather some background information. So, the public members and behavior analysts and the public may not fully appreciate how the ethical code was amended. Why? Heidi, what statute were you referring to when you discussed anyone who's trained by the military?
It is, I think, the one that precedes universal recognition. I can't remember the citation off the top of my head.
Thank you.
And that's all I had.
All right. So are we in agreement then, board committee, that we want to take this to the board?
Oh.
As a whole, right? That's what you're looking for, Heidi, as a whole document to review these recommended or suggested changes for a bit broader discussion with the board.
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe so. I will, I need to do some research clearly. So this is likely before the board in January.
Okay. So do we need a motion to take these ideas to the board, Ms. Galvin?
Yes. So a motion to approve the changes as outlined by Ms. Pekkanen, with the exception of the code of conduct, and recommend that she take those items to the full board, get approval by the governor's office, etc.
Why is the code of conduct being left off?
It's not being left off. The motion, as stated, is giving Heidi approval to kind of start the rulemaking process, but with further discussion about the rules of professional conduct at the board. We're not recommending at this time that we update the ethics code. Right. Just that it'll go to the full board for discussion.
Right. I don't feel confident updating it to the 2008 rules until I understand the history. I don't understand, and there's obviously history somewhere. So let's talk about it. Unless the other, I mean, we can have a vote.
Do we need to include in the motion some of the kind of action items left open for Ms. Pakkanen? I know there have been a few, like with the fee sharing, for example, or with the other kind of discussion that we had during the meeting.
Yes. Yeah. I think she has that on her list, to-do list, along with
the yeah. And okay. I guess I can move, you know, what essentially Ms. Gavin said with that addition.
All right. Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. And then we will also then take the rules of professional conduct forward as a discussion.
As well as the multicultural.
As well as the multicultural concept for continuing education.
That'll be accompanied by my resignation.
All right, well, it's a discussion. All right, so do we need a motion for that, or we can just put that on the agenda, right?
You can. Just put it on the agenda if you would like.
Thank you, Ms. Galpin. All right, I don't think there are any more agenda items. Is there any agenda items for the future meetings? All right, hearing none. And is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Seconded.
We got a motion, and thank you. Thank you, both of you. Motion and second, but thank you, staff, for everything. Ms. Galvin, thank you for always leading us on all the legal issues. And thank you, committee members, for being part of this meeting today. So we have a motion and second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right. Everybody have a great week. Motion carries, and we'll see you at the next board meeting.
Thank you.